Welcome. If you're a first-time listener, this is a show where my dad, documentary maker Steve Thomas, otherwise known as Wolf, and I, Daniel Thomas, writer, actor, and filmmaker, otherwise known as Cub, dive into some docos, feature films, and series. Naturally, we share a few personal anecdotes, some filmmaking knowledge, and a bit of banter about football. It's been a little while between episodes in this second series, but we are now bringing you a two-part endeavor into the saga that is The Staircase. In the first episode, we will be comparatively discussing the documentary series on Netflix and the HBO dramatized version starring Colin Firth and Toni Collette. In the second episode, we'll introduce a new doco called Subject, which explores the participants in documentaries and the ethics of representing real people in films. Subject looks at five docos, one of which happens to be The Staircase, and features Margie Ratliff, a daughter of the accused in the doco series. We've been lucky in getting Margie as a guest on the film club, and we'll also feature our conversation with her. So let's get into this first part. A little something to be aware of, whenever there is a major spoiler, you'll hear the sound of a howling wolf to give you guys a heads up. Let's get into it.
The doco series The Staircase was first released around 2004. So we're nearly 20 years ago now. I was introduced to it by our old friend, the great late Peter Davis, who was addicted to the series. At that stage, I think it was 8 episodes. And I remember him bringing down from Ferntree Gully a VHS tape with, you know, the first 3 apps on, and by which time I was hooked and I had to watch the rest. So in summary, this is a film that was 15 years in the making, in the sense that the first series was released in 2004, and then because of the way events panned out, the filmmakers made another 3 or 4 episodes 10 years later, and the whole thing is now available on Netflix. It was one of the first earliest kind of true crime docos. I mean, it was seminal in that sense. And of course, now true crime is everywhere in documentaries and podcasts and all the rest of it. But then it was a fairly new genre. It was made by a French film team in America, led by, I'm not sure I can pronounce this properly, Jean-Xavier de Lestrade. How does that sound, Dan?
It sounds pretty good in terms of our history of names.
Yeah, I've looked elsewhere for his work, and he had won an Oscar when he made The Staircase for a film called Murder on a Sunday Morning. So crime was always a thing for Lestrade, but I haven't been able to access that doco. I think it's on HBO in America, but it doesn't seem to be on any of the streaming services. The film's set in Durham, North Carolina, and it centres on a family called the Peterson family. Kathleen Peterson, the mother. And should I introduce the notion at this? Oh, Dan, introduce the notion of what we're going to do when there's spoilers.
Because spoilers are a regular occurrence, obviously, on the show, we are going to introduce a howling wolf sound so that we don't have to repeat ourselves with you guys. So if there is a particularly big spoiler coming up, the sound of a howling wolf will warn you guys of that.
So Kathleen Peterson, the mother, is found dead at the bottom of the stairs. It appears, to all intents and purposes, to be an accident. But a short while later, her husband, Michael Peterson, is charged with first-degree murder by the local district attorney. And the film follows the case to the conviction of Peterson for murder, And then 10 years later, the doco makers pick up the story when certain new evidence comes to light and there are new appeals and court appearances that follow. So the series was completed, I think, around 2018. So it was a seminal film in the sense of being true crime. It's a fly-on-the-wall film. There's no narration. You do occasionally get a glimpse of the doco team, and sometimes they're referred to, but essentially it's an an observational film. And you might wonder why Michael Peterson was interested in having a documentary made about his travails with the legal system. The crew were looking to make a film about the Western legal system and its efficacy and how well it works. They were also looking for a family story. They heard about the Peterson case, approached Michael Peterson, and he decided to invite the doco team into his life to follow the case come what may. Because he was in, I mean, he was claiming, of course, that he was innocent, and but he was very interested in seeing whether the legal, how well and whether the legal system in America works. So the film, particularly on Netflix, is advertised as a kind of whodunit. Did he do it? Didn't he do it? But for me, really, it's a film about the function or dysfunction, if you like, of the legal system. And it's also a film about family and about family loyalties.
I just think it was interesting that, particularly the first scene, how it launched straight into it. So the first scene is actually Michael Peterson describing the events of the night where the incident happened. And it's our first introduction to him. And it's interesting to watch him because perhaps not only is he going through the event, but he's probably trying to get used to the cameras in his face. But I agree with you. There's many themes around family and the judicial system in America. And it's quite, I found it quite grueling in terms of the length of the first trial and then the reopening of the case. But by the end of it, it was pretty taxing as a viewer, like to be on board with that all the way through.
Yeah, it is taxing. And I guess if you kind of regard it as some form of entertainment, it's not that taxing. But while you're watching it, you're putting yourself in the shoes of that family and of Michael Peterson, who waited 2 years for his first trial, a trial that ran 3 months, and then a jury who were out for 4 full days while they considered the verdict. And all of this is followed by the documentary makers in forensic detail. I mean, 7 1-hour or 7 50-minute episodes to cover that first trial. And then he languishes in jail, having been convicted, for another 10 years, after which all appeals have been exhausted unsuccessfully. But new evidence comes to light, and so there are fresh grounds for seeking a retrial. And you're watching this family who turn up to court every day to support their father. And you're watching the distress that they go through. It's not just grueling to watch. It's very difficult to watch these people going through this process.
And I found myself continuously swinging between the evidence in my own mind and trying to piece together my own, as a member of the jury would, trying to piece together my own kind of take on it, with the first hand account going on from Michael Peterson and family at the same time. But what's classic is the uncanny plot twists. So I think they're 4 weeks out of the first trial beginning, and it comes to light wolf sound. That there was a prior incident in the 80s. Do you want to explain that first?
Yeah, well, it becomes apparent that this is not the first time that Michael Peterson has been involved in the death of a woman apparently falling down the stairs. He lived in Germany with his first wife, you know, many years prior. They had a close friend or a family who were close friends. The father was killed, I think, in a road accident. And then the mother died in an apparent fall down the stairs. And she, in fact, was the mother of the two daughters in the staircase, Margie and Martha, who Michael Peterson, after the death of the mother and the father was already dead, he and his wife at the time adopted the two girls and brought them up as their own. He's now into his second marriage. I can't remember how it's revealed in the doco or how the district attorney finds out. But when they find out that this is the second time that Peterson has been present in a fall down the stairs, of course, everybody's saying, well, lightning doesn't strike twice and he must be guilty.
It's a revelation. It's really a shock to the defense attorney, because it's an absolute revelation that the same thing in different contexts or the same set of a similar set of circumstances in completely different contexts have happened. So the defense attorney are clear that it's gonna impact the jury's. How can it not influence the jury's verdict? So that with a very short time to go, the defense attorney are trying to remove it from the evidence, which obviously they attempt to, and that they can't.
Well, I would add there, a rider, that in fact lightning can strike twice, and in fact there's a doco by Peter Greenaway. One of his early short films, I think he might have been at film school at the time. It's called Act of God, I think. And it's a series of interviews with people who've been struck by lightning in England. And I'm pretty sure there's a guy in there who's been struck a second time. So on my hypothesis that truth is stranger than fiction, and this is why I love the documentary form, lightning actually can strike twice, and in this case, that's the defense belief. But of course, it's a strong influence on the jury, quite clearly, along with the second revelation about Michael Peterson, which is that he's bisexual and has been having meetings, affairs, I don't know what you call them, with men. As well as being married. And of course, the defense feel that his personal life is his own, and they appeal to the judge that this is not relevant to the case. But again, the judge allows it. And of course, the district attorney's case is that Kathleen found out about his bisexuality. They had a fight about it, and he killed her with the blow poke at the bottom of the stairs.
It's interesting what you said about the narrative thing, because if you did write that in a narrative, that if you literally wrote a similar set of circumstances happened, it probably wouldn't sit. But that's why your argument, truth is stranger than fiction, has a lot of weight to it, because I think if you tried to write that in a narrative sense, it would be a little bit
exactly.
Ridiculous.
Exactly. And I remember the lawyer, David Rudolph, who's the lawyer throughout this, you know, entire time, he turns to the camera and says, this film's got a lot more interesting for you all of a sudden. So it's it's the plot twist at exactly the moment that you would throw in a plot twist.
Yeah. If it was the 21-minute mark.
Yeah. And for me, one of the reasons why the doco works so well is that the lawyer Rudolph and the private investigator that he employs, they're kind of archetypal figures, you know. He's the debonair Jewish lawyer who's interested in social justice. His private eye is this sort of hard-bitten, unkempt private detective. They're like classic characters that you would find in a drama. They couldn't be cast better than they are. And of course, Michael Peterson himself is a very interesting character and a quite enigmatic character and quite prone to philosophizing to the camera with his pipe, you know, smoking his pipe.
Well, he's a writer with a number of published 10 or so books, a fiction writer. So, yeah, he's very good with his storytelling.
Yeah, but he's interesting too, and it doesn't come through so much in the drama. But he makes a number of statements about life and the kind of randomness of life. And at the end, he says something like, I've got it written down here, "I don't know what life's about. What happens seems to be purely random. Things just happen. If only I'd known to tell Kathleen not to go indoors and upstairs, but nothing has gone the way that I thought it would." And when he's convicted, you know, and he's looking at the media coverage, he says, "I don't recognize this person. This media presentation of me by, you know, the press and TV and so on, I'm somebody else. The whole thing has become a show, and defense is as bad as the prosecution. They just want to win, and they're not that interested in the truth." He becomes bankrupt, essentially. He says at some point, they're talking about the cost of the case, that it's costing $750,000 for his defense team through this long process. And of course, that's $750,000 that he doesn't have. So you're led to ask these questions about the legal system. What happens if you can't afford a good legal team? What happens if like a local case that Anne and I know about, where the person involved is on a disability pension, but because he owns a house, he can't get legal aid. So the way the legal system functions or doesn't function is important subtext of this film and was behind the purpose of it in the first place. And Michael Peterson's final words in the doco are, you know, "In the end, all are punished." That's a quote from Romeo and Juliet. All are punished, all are punished. And by that he means himself, his family, his wife's family, the defense team, all have been punished by the legal process as far as he is concerned.
Yeah, a couple of things. Just the, in terms of his philosophizing, his take on his second life or his bisexual life is interesting too, because he basically claims that he was devoted in love to Kathleen, and that these escapades off to the side were merely loveless exchanges, and that it didn't have any impact on his marriage, and that she was aware of that, and that he could function in this kind of double life in a way. His philosophies around that were interesting. And just on the system thing you're saying, and the questioning of the system, was interesting how that impacted Rudolph, the defense lawyer. He was, after the first trial, he was deeply dismayed and viscerally impacted by the judicial system, and jaded, but just a complete loss of faith in the process. And I think you can tell it really kicked, in terms of this punishing thing, it really kicked him as this kind of charismatic law figure. You know, I find legal stuff really interesting to watch. You know, the watching the legal team trying to piece everything together, I can really see the appeal of that to somebody who's interested in interested in law, all the different avenues you can go down, and you know the things that are coming into play. But yeah, it definitely had a severe impact on him as well as the family as a whole.
Yeah, I think he describes it as a dark tunnel that he's been down. And at one stage, he actually pulls out from being Peterson's lawyer and says, you know, I can't go on. But the next plot twist, of course, is that unbeknownst to them, although in hindsight it's perhaps not a big surprise when you look at the way things were presented in the original trial, it comes to light that one of the prosecution forensic investigators is corrupt. So Randolph's dark tunnel emerges into new possibilities for a retrial. And that's the second part of the doco, which was picked up again by the same documentary team in 2015 or wherever it was. After Michael Peterson had been in jail for 10 years, he's then on house arrest for 3 years while they try and sort out whether or not there can be a retrial. And in the end, there can't be a retrial because the evidence has not been looked after properly and it's been prejudiced and spoilt. And so they end up in a kind of catch-22 where he's granted a retrial, but it's actually not really possible to have that retrial.
A few things just to wrap that one up. I found his... In the first trial, when he was when the guilty verdict was given, I did find his reaction really interesting. He was quite calm or reserved, matter of fact. But the thing is, he turned to his family and basically said, "It's okay, it's okay." And at first, I was wondering, you know, because I was swinging in my mind between everything and casting different, call it, opinions, and I was wondering, what does that reaction say? And at first, I thought if I was in a case where I'd been wrongly accused and then suddenly I was found guilty, I'd probably start pleading and begging, and like it was just kind of maybe desperation in a way, you know. And but then I sort of looked at it in the way that he was actually potentially doing remaining matter of fact for the protection of his family, for the daughters. He was holding it together for them. And so I started to see it in that light. That was one comment. The other thing we didn't address was the blow poke. I didn't even know what a blow poke is, right? For anyone who might not know, I think you stoke the fire and blow the fire in the house with it to get the fire going. So it's essentially almost like a, you know, it's a weighty metal, almost like a crowbar, but you can blow air through it. And that had essentially been missing, and suddenly towards the end of the trial, it appeared, and it had been in the garage covered in cobwebs. So the blow poke kept coming into play. That was another plot twist that happened towards the end, was the appearance of the actual blow poke.
And just
another interesting thing, a little side thing, is that I enjoyed watching another narrative series about the O.J. Simpson case, and a similar thing happened where it was discovered that one of the cops involved was basically a right-wing guy. They really jumped on that, and it cast massive doubt about this cop because he had some kind of neo-Nazi activity going on. So again, there's the main players and then there's all the supporting characters, and some of those supporting characters can have just as big an impact on the case, even if they're not one of the main kind of people involved.
Well, I think that's an interesting reference to the OJ case, which I watched that doco series a couple of years ago, and it's an interesting companion piece to The Staircase, really. But yeah, no, I agree with you about Michael Peterson's reaction when he's convicted. And I recall he says something like, from jail, he says, the older you get, you lose ego and you start to worry about other people instead of just yourself. And he said, it's my family that I'm concerned about. And of course, the family I was going to say are united. They're not quite united. But the family, which includes Martha and Margie, the adopted daughters, two sons from Michael Peterson's first marriage and a daughter from his second marriage, have all remained throughout absolutely loyal to their father. Except for the biological daughter, who teams up with the two evil sisters of Kathleen, who resolutely turn against Michael Peterson from the very start and are united all the way through. So they are also supporting characters, if you like, in this drama that add to the whole mix of tension and conflicting views and all of that.
And much, very much after processing of the whole thing and the impact on so many people involved over such a long period of time with both trials, and something that the participants are still coming to grips with.
Well, they're coming to grips with all that, and with the second part of the series, the return of the Doco crew. The whole thing is put out on Netflix, and then HBO announced that they are funding a drama, a narrative version of this story, the rights to which they've bought, not from the family, but from the documentary makers. I've watched the whole of the drama.
Let me be transparent about this with our dear listeners, because there's some confusing distribution issues here in Germany, and often I can't find some of the films we're looking at. So I instead went down a YouTube rabbit hole, and there was far more on there than I thought. So there was a complete someone had cut together, and I thought this was an interesting exercise to watch, cut together the scenes from the Doco series and the scenes from the narrative side by side. And you could literally watch comparisons between a lot of the key scenes. So I watched all that. There was also a behind the scenes making of the narrative, and there was a number of breakdowns of the episodes. So I got a lot of information through doing that, and it was pretty classic, to be honest.
In what sense?
Well, the budget on this thing, obviously bouncing off the interest in the Doco series, they've jumped on it and funded it. So they built an entire replica of the house in a sound studio.
Okay.
They went to the original house. They measured it up, as an architect does, and they built an entire replica with, you know, the bathrooms a little bit bigger to allow for the crew. They reckon they replicated the staircase to an absolute T. They had green screen versions of the staircase that they were overlaying for the incident. And the way they were breaking this stuff down, I was just looking at the extraordinary amounts of money being spent, and then all of a sudden this owl appeared. So this scene of an owl or a bird swooping down and clawing Kathleen on the head was, I was like, I gotta ask Dad, where did the owl come from? Did I miss something in the Doco series? Because I'm like, why is there a bird sweeping down on her? And then the creators explained that the bird was kind of a representative of the other, like this. It was like reflected a circumstance that was different to anything. And I was
That's
like,
bullshit. There actually was. It's not in the documentary, but there actually was a theory that she was attacked and clawed on the head on her way back in from the garden late at night by an owl. And there were precedents for this kind of attack. And I think it's a neighbour of the Petersons who first came up with this theory. but it never really caught on and is not included in the documentary, but is the true part of the story.
Yeah, well, thanks for clarifying that, because I was a bit confused. But they reckon during the making of the narrative, a bird randomly swooped down.
Oh, okay.
Coincidentally. And then just from watching the scenes and what I saw of the performances, particularly with Colin Firth, yeah, it all felt a bit obviously dramatized, but how would you not dramatize it? And I also found it interesting there was three parallel time lines going. So there was the past, the present, and the future was my take on it, all kind of meeting at various stages. But in watching the side by side, I found the casting interesting. I found the little subtle changes in the real life dialogue. You know, a lot of it was close, but you could see where they pivoted a little bit. It was interesting to see the side by side.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, you've only seen those elements which were similar to the Doco storyline, but in fact the drama plays fast and loose with the story. So, for example, Kathleen is a character, which of course she's not in the documentary because she's dead, but in the drama, through the device of flashbacks, she is a constant presence in the film. And where they got the Kathleen storyline from, I don't know. But they also introduced the owl theory, and they play out Kathleen's death in the three possible, or the three hypothesized ways. You see her die from a fall down the stairs. You see her die having been attacked by an owl and then stumbling on the stairs and falling down. And you see the third version, which is, of course, Michael Peterson beating her to death with a blowpoke. What was the point of doing that, you know? What's the point of seeing her die three times over each time in a very bloody and distressing way? What are the filmmakers trying to achieve by that, apart from the fact that they know they can do it because it's a drama?
I think that was their way of having, call it a non-biased opinion, was, well, we'll just throw down three scenarios and then we've got all bases covered.
Yeah, and people can make up their own minds. They also throw in the affair, which again is a true story, between Michael Peterson and the editor of the documentary, Sophie, who's played quite well, I thought, by Juliette Binoche. These are ways in which the story is very differently told in the drama. And I think the main thing for me is the raison d'etre for the doco is the court proceedings. And we're constantly coming back to court for the next hearing and the next hearing. And the drama spends one episode, or the equivalent of one of eight episodes, in court. The rest is the family, Michael's bisexuality, alleged frictions and difficulties within the family, favoritism over the kids by Michael, a couple of eps spent on his time in jail, which isn't covered at all in the doco. And Michael Peterson's response to that is they could only have got that from the book that I wrote, and which they've never paid me any kind of recompense for. But in the documentary, you get a very clear sense of the aging process for Michael Peterson as he goes through the years. I mean, I think when Kathleen dies, he's close to 60, and by the end of the documentary, he's close to 80. Not only do you see him age in a way which doesn't happen in the drama, you know, a bit of makeup on Colin Firth is about as far as they go, but you also see the effect of jail on him quite clearly. His physical condition deteriorates severely over the 10 years or whatever it is, 8 to 10 years that he's in jail. And I think that's something which the documentary gives a sense of, which you'll never get a sense of in the drama, because you know Colin Firth hasn't aged. It's just a bit of makeup. So there's that authenticity that the documentary has.
Yeah, that was interesting. He was visibly, he visibly aged, was very weathered or impacted by the jail time. I don't know. I just thought of the only other time I've sort of seen that is with Obama. You watched him age as a president, but that's not that wasn't in a documentary sense. I'm just saying, you look at Obama at the start of his presidency and the end, he like really aged naturally. But yeah, it's actually a really good point relative to the drama series, that you just don't get that sense of real time.
Yeah, the drama is not concerned really with the legal questions and the court process, which was the raison d'etre for the documentary. And so it's very, very different. And when you mention Colin Firth, and Toni Collette plays Kathleen, how can Colin Firth play this part? He doesn't know ultimately whether as a character he did it or not, because the end product of the documentary is open.
I just think he would have tried to hook into empathy for him.
Well, he looks to me like he's struggling, Colin. He looks to me like he doesn't want to be there. And not only that, but he's having to put on a Southern American accent at the same time.
But there is that's what I mean with that opening scene in the doco, is that, like, perhaps Michael Peterson is also, you know, he's tussling with the cameras in his face, and perhaps Colin Firth's reflection, which I could see a little bit as well. But I don't know if that was also his kind of like underlying tussle with the kind of spectacle of it all.
I don't know what the drama people were after. I mean, it's interesting because the end of the drama, the very final shot, Michael has pleaded guilty to manslaughter because that's the only way to solve the case. He goes home, he has a row with his family and tells them he doesn't want to, you know, he wants to be on his own. He sits down and he looks into the camera and he holds your gaze. And that's the final shot. Now, what is this, a kind of knowing look between him and us, that really, after all that, he's acknowledging that he did it? Or is it the filmmaker's attempt to keep the thing open and force us to make a decision? It's bullshit. The end of the doco series, Michael Peterson says, all are punished. And then he sits down and he puts on that song, Everybody Knows, by Leonard Cohen. And in the playing of the song, we fade to the credits. I've got it down here somewhere. Everybody knows that dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. And I think that's a fantastic ending, really. Colin Firth looking into the camera and going, I'm not sure how I played this fucking role. What do you think? Doesn't impress me. I have to say, it doesn't impress me.
So do you think the narrative had a bias?
It's hard to say, but I think because you don't go through the trial really with Michael in the drama and all of the ups and downs that produces. And because in the end, he voluntarily seems to plead guilty to manslaughter rather than the form of words which he insists on using in the doco, I think it does lean towards guilt, yeah. It does lean towards guilt. And I think there's an implication in the drama, I'm not too sure about this, but that Kathleen finds out his bisexuality on the night that she died. And I don't think that was not the case that was presented in the documentary anyway.
And as you say, when there was more focus on just the evidence in court, like I said earlier, you could potentially sit yourself in the place of the juror and just make kind of assessments on the evidence. But if, you know, the narrative's all about backstory and like you say, where did they get that Kathleen kind of backstory? It's a different type of narrative, obviously. I think my gripe, particularly with the drama, is I think it's really awesome as a filmmaker when you know projects are being funded and there's work for everybody. Like I fully wish and hope and encourage that. But then when I see the phenomenal amounts of money being spent off the back of a documentary that's already had a lot of interest, and then these phenomenal amounts of money being spent on replicating like houses and having free reign on the thing, it's great that the work's there, but is it necessary, and is the expense necessary? But it's all part of the business machine and the model of you know this current model of streaming and the machine behind it all.
Well, that must be it, because I can't think of a good reason why you need to dramatize a good documentary. I can see lots of reasons why you might make a documentary about a drama or behind the scenes of the drama or whatever. The rider in the credits of the drama is that this is a dramatization based on certain facts. That's what it actually says.
It's pretty vague.
I mean, yeah. Yes, yeah, you know, vague. What does that mean? Where does that come from? So stories where there can't be documentaries, or there aren't satisfactory documentaries, or it's a story that's really hard to tell in a documentary, so it gets told as a drama. Yeah, I understand that. But why you would make a drama of a perfectly adequate and more than adequate documentary,
If you enjoyed this first part, please tune in to the next episode for our look at subject and our conversation with Margie Ratliff. You can also hit us up on the Instagram at Wolf Cub Film Club. Thank you for all the support. Catch you on the next episode.